UK Wine Show, show number 213. Andrea Gentilin Milan on Brazil. Oi, bumta, bumtad. Or as I say, hello, good day and good evening in Portuguese, or at least that's the language they say in Brazil. And this week we're off to Brazil to find out about the Brazilian wine industry. Now, in the UK, as the sun bathes down on us, and a lovely week we've had weather-wise, and the Kiwis leave the World Cup, not in disgrace, unlike some countries like France and Italy, but with their heads held high because they've never actually got any points in the World Cup before. I think they did really well. And England is going to play arch-enemy Germany, which is almost certainly going to land up in a draw and a penalty shootout, and that is every Englishman's nightmare. But we're going to be visiting Brazil, one of the world's top soccer countries, and we're going to be finding out about the Brazilian wine industry with Andrea Gentilin Milan from the Wines of Brazil, all about the Brazilian wine industry. Now, Brazil produces one of my favourite styles of wine at the moment. It's a bit like a Moscato d'Asti, and we're going to be finding out about the style of wine as well as the Brazilian wine scene. And strangely, why Brazil, a Portuguese-speaking nation, has closer ties with the Italians than the Portuguese. We'll get onto that later on the show, but to start off with, we're going to start with our unusual mystery producer. Well, they're sort of a producer or maybe a brand, it depends on how you look at it. And as usual, I'm going to give you the clue now, I'm going to give you a clue before the interview and then the answer at the end of the show. So here's our mystery producer slash brand. You'll see why when I give you the explanation why I'm being a bit obtuse. Our mystery producer is a joint venture in California between producers Robert Mondavi, now owned by Constellation, and Mouton Rothschild, the Bordeaux producer. It makes only one wine, apart from a very limited production wine called Overture, which it sells to visitors at its winery. Now, the main wine, though, is a Bordeaux-style wine from the Napa Valley, which has Cabernet Sauvignon, bit of Cabernet Franc, Merlot, Petit Verdot, and a wee bit of Malbec, so it's quite a mixture there. And was America's very, very first ultra-premium wine. The venture came about after Baron Philip de Rothschild met Robert Mondavi in 1970 and proposed the idea of trying to create a California equivalent of a Bordeaux first growth. However, it wasn't officially announced until a decade later, a year after Mouton Rothschild's winemaker Lucien Sonneau and Robert's son Timothy created the partnership's first vintage at the Robert Mondavi Winery. Have we think about that, I'll give you the next clue after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. More medals than ever before were handed out this week at the English and Welsh Wine of the Year competition, judged by five Masters of Wine and chaired by Susan McCraith MW. The strongest style categories were still rosés, dry whites and sparkling wines. Six gold medals were awarded in the still rosé category, with the top trophy going to Camel Valley for its Fortnum & Mason Rosé 2009. Bacchus took the lead in the still dry whites category, with Chapeldown Bacchus 2009 winning the trophy for best commercial production, and best sparkling wine went to Ridgeview for their Grosvenor Blanc de Blanc 2001, bottled in Magnums. The wine was also voted the Wine of the Year. The last star of the show was Eglantine's North Star 2006, which won a gold medal in the dessert wine category. The wine's made with 100% Madeleine Angevine and gained a gold medal in France in Venelis earlier this year.
I've been saying for quite a while to a lot of people that England makes some cracking rosé. Some of the best rosés I've had are English rosé, and it's good that they're starting to get recognition in the competitions. The North Star is a cracking wine. We use it in some of our tastings and it's very good. And one time we compared it to a German Auslese of quite good quality, a Schlosslese, and to a group of Germans, and they had no idea which was theirs and which was the English one. So it is quite a nice wine. It is made a bit funny though. The grapes are late harvest, which is, as it's sold as a late harvest wine, but they freeze the grapes and then make it into an ice wine style. It isn't an official way of making ice wine as defined by Europe, so they can't call it ice wine, but it does make for a very interesting wine. I have tried another one of these cryogenic style wines in Penedès in Spain when I visited Grimona way back in show 133, But the stuff was pretty awful. So this cryogenic wine can be a bit of great stuff or terrible stuff, just like normal wine, I suppose. Perhaps some of these award-winning wines will replace some of the lost booze cruise to France. What's going on there, Jane?
Well, British retailers Tesco and Sainsbury's are to close their wine outlets in northern France, signalling the end of the booze cruise to stock up on cheap wine and beer. The weak pound on UK supermarkets offering cheap alcohol, together with the recession, has put a stop to consumers visiting Calais to stock up, and business at the outlets is reported to have dried up almost. Tesco Van Plus has consulted with staff over the closure, and Sainsbury's is to shut down its Calais wine store at the end of the month, describing its partnership with French retailer Auchan as no longer viable. A third large outlet, Odbin's Calais, closed earlier this year, and the company confirmed its franchise agreement has come to an end. But Majestics say they will stick it out in France, claiming the difference in duty is still enough to attract savvy shoppers, but blaming the relative strength of the euro on a 28% fall in sales for the year ending March 2010 in its three northern France stores.
I must admit, it took me quite a while to work out what Majestic was saying about the drop in sales. I can't quite see how the euro affects a drop in sales. The difference between the price in the UK and France is really just about the duty difference, or at least it should be. But in France, with a strong euro, the costs of running shops are priced in euros. And so the staff costs, rent, water, all that sort of stuff gets stronger and more expensive as it runs, which means the profitability of the stores will drop. But I can't see why the number of punters coming across the ditch should drop because of the strong euro, because you're still getting a margin on the difference. What could make a difference, though, is the change in duty, with the VAT going up from 17.5% to 20% in January next year. That means the difference in price will improve. It'll make about 10 pence difference to a £5 bottle of wine. Anyway, Jane, what's the next story?
Finally this week, the 2010 New Zealand vintage has come in, 19,000 tonnes smaller than in 2009, at 266,000 tonnes. It's good news for grape growers and wineries who had planned for a reduced crop to adjust supply imbalances over the last 2 years. New Zealand wine growers CEO Philip Gregan said the vintage quality should be excellent due to lower yields combined with great weather conditions, which should deliver superb fruit. The 2010 harvest was lower in most of New Zealand's key wine growing regions. In Marlborough, the vintage was down 5%. The Hawke's Bay crop was also down 5%. But the harvest in Gisborne reduced 21% from 2009. In central Otago, production was unchanged on 2009. And in Waipara, Canterbury and Northland, the harvest was actually larger this year. That's it from me this week, but don't forget, you can get these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. I think the drop in harvest is welcomed by most of the industry, and the Kiwis have worked hard to get the quantity down by 7% across the country, which is not bad going. And with the boost that's coming from exports based on the softening New Zealand price for wine, you're starting to see New Zealand come back into balance. And if they get another lowish year of production, then the tanks might start to finally empty out and they'll be back onto that good old growth road with nice high prices. We're actually going to be looking a bit more at New Zealand and some of the oddball regions in there, and we're going to start off next week by looking at Pegasus Bay in Waipara, which is a very established New Zealand producer in North Canterbury. Then we're going to be heading back up to one of the granddaddies in New Zealand viticulture, or at least in Martinborough, Martinborough Vineyards. Now, the news we read out this week isn't all the news, and there was a couple of items that caught my eye. Obviously, there was no duty rise, which was important, even though we're going to get stuck with a 2.5% increase in VAT to 20% VAT in January next year, which will put a bit of pressure on the wine pricing. But the other piece of news that caught my eye was a bit of wine fraud by Tesco's. Now, Mr. Danny McGowan bought a couple of bottles of white burgundy, the Louis Jardot Puy Fusse at Tesco's, reduced from £15 down to £5 a bottle, so a bit of a bargain there. Now, you might say, okay, sounds a bit dodgy, you know, something that's too good to be true usually isn't, and in this case it wasn't. When he opened the wine, he realised something was immediately wrong. Now, he doesn't claim to be an expert, in fact, he's quoted as saying, I'm not an expert, but I know my wines. Now, the label was Puy Fusse, which was a French dry white burgundy, but it tasted a bit sweeter and a bit more like a German hock, according to him, and was probably worth around £3 a bottle. Mr. McGowan said the label also looked photocopied, and the bottle had a screw cap instead of the unusual cork. Or that said, though, I have seen Chablis under screw cap. That's not necessarily a giveaway. According to Tesco's, a very small number of counterfeit bottles have been found, and fortunately, most were uncovered in the supply chain before reaching the shelves. So Tesco's have been selling fraudulent wine, and they know about it as well. It's just disappointing that they didn't fess up to this before they got caught out. And it makes me wonder how often this happens. You know, how often do Tesco's sell fake wines, or any of the other supermarkets for that matter? I certainly know in the wine trade, if you're buying high-end wines, you certainly need to know where it's coming from. One way of working out where wine's coming from is by reading lots of books, because in our spotlight, we're reviewing Oz Clark's book, Let Me Tell You About Wine. This is Oz's latest book. It's very much an introduction book. So let's crack into the book review. Let Me Tell You About Wine by Oz Clark. Now, I thought this book was one of the best introduction to wine books I'd read. I think it gets the balance between topical facts and useful information almost perfect, and is written in Oz Clark's usual fun and disarming approach. Now, I've read an awful lot of introduction to wine books over the years, and some of them are very good, and some of them are pretty awful. But Oz manages to create an engaging book that's perfect for the novice and the enthusiastic quaffer, rather than enthusiastic amateur who knows a wee bit about wine. The first third of the book focuses on the styles of wines produced rather than grape varieties or regions, and he puts us in a wee bit of a different way looking at the style of wine. I really like the way he's done it. He then fits the styles of wines to a wheel. Now, it's not a radical idea, I know, a wheel, but the way it is with the styles around the outside and intensity increasing from the inside, it gives a nice way of looking about where different wines are. So he might describe New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc on the wheel, or maybe a Chablis on the wheel. And I like it, actually. I thought it was very, very good. He does this for the whites and reds, with a different wheel for each. After that, he rattles through quite a few grape varieties. And the initial descriptions of the grape varieties show a range of styles that can be produced from that grape variety, as well as a bit of food pairing and locations. The range of wines covered in depth is very limited. 4 for red, 3 for white. So you're looking at really the big grape varieties. But he does give a brief overview of the next 42 most common grape varieties. But they are really covered in quite a shallow way. So it really is a beginner's book for grape varieties. And if that's the case, then what he's covering is pretty good, actually. The middle section, part two, as he labels it, is all about enjoying wine. And it covers a range of topics about wine, from wine and food matching, restaurant etiquette, tasting, serving, and even how to open a bottle of wine. Some are very basic, and some are a bit more technical and interesting, such as wine and health. It was interesting to see how he covers these topics, as he's an excellent writer and someone who keeps a firm eye on the pulse of the wine industry and is able to explain quite technical aspects with a mixture of authority but irrelevance. The third third of the book rattles through the key wine regions of the world. The maps are okay and the text gives just enough information to be a bit more confident buying them. But the information is pretty standard and uninspiring. Overall, I think this is an excellent beginner's guide to wine. It lacks anything radical, but it is an ideal beginner's guide for wine. For those who want something a bit more than Michael Schuster's Wine Tasting or Beverly Blanding's Choosing the Right Wine, I think are more technical and better books for the content. But for the beginner looking at an enjoyable start to wine, I think this is the book to go for. And I've rated it 90 out of 100, so quite a good rating there. One region Oz does not cover is Brazil in his book. I think it's a bit too small for the book. And we're going to be finding out about Brazil in the interview, which is coming up next. But I'm going to give you the mystery producer slash brand before we get into that. Now, in the early 80s, Mondavi sold off part of the celebrated Tucolón vineyard to the collaboration for its first vineyard. And a 50-acre ranch in Oakville was purchased for the winery, which was completed in 1991. Despite Constellation assuming a 50% control of this mystery wine in 2004 when it bought Robert Mondavi's corporation, the venture has been operating independently in respect to all vineyard management, sales and administration. The winery these days produces about 25,000 cases of wine a year, which are sold worldwide. I'll give you the answer to that mystery producer slash brand after the interview, which is coming up next with Andrea, all about Brazilian wines. Let's have a listen to what she has to say. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Andrea Gentileni Milan. She's the export manager for Wines of Brazil, a bit of a strange region, but how are you, Andrea?
I'm fine, and you?
Very good indeed. We're going to talk a wee bit about Brazilian wine region today and just find out a bit about it and how it works. But how long have you been with Wines of Brazil?
For the last 4 years.
4 years? Oh, excellent. And you guys, we're actually recording this at the London International Wine Fair in Excel, just East London. But you've been coming here for quite a while as well, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
How long have you been coming to the show?
This is the sixth time that you are coming. And it was the first trade fair we came when Wines from Brazil started, just at the beginning.
Yeah.
We believe a lot in that market. UK is the main import country on the world, so...
That's the country
just started, and you believe a lot on that.
And are you getting quite good traction here? I haven't seen your wines in the shops, but I've tried them a few times. I like some of them a lot.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's a tough market.
Yeah.
But we got so far 3 brands on the market. So Miolo, that is the main company. You can see on some of the shops they have a line called Alísios do Ceival, so you can find it. Somewhere at Waitrose, you can find also Rio Sol, that's from the northeast of Brazil. So it's still at the beginning, but in the near future, I hope that you can find a lot of Brazilian wines in the market.
Fantastic. Just let's get a big overview of Brazil. Obviously, you're South America. The country starts just below the equator, doesn't it?
The main wine region, it's very south of Brazil. It's more nearby Argentina and Uruguay. It's in between 32 and 29 parallel south. It's on the mountain region, so people can have an idea how is the climate there. Some people say that is the little Tuscany. And it makes sense because when the Italians went to Brazil, they went to the mountains, and it was the place when they came with the grapevines in Brazil as well.
Fantastic. And let's talk about the wine regions. There's one big wine region, and you've got quite a lot of diversity around other wine regions. What are the key wine regions in Brazil?
The key wine region, it's called Serra Gaúcha. So Serra Gaúcha, it accounts for about 8,000 hectares. And it's a great wine region for the sparkling wines and some of the reds as Merlot and Cabernet Franc. So it's on the hills. It's about 600 meters altitude. Sometimes you can have snow, no beaches. So, but it's a very nice place. 4 seasons. So that's the main wine region that you have in Brazil.
Okay. You said they made sparkling wines. The Brazilian wines I really like, or the one that really got my attention, was strangely an Italian style wine, like Moscato d'Asti. It was like a sparkling Moscato, low alcohol, sweet. Nice grapey notes, just like a nice Moscato d'Asti. Is that produced in Serra Gaúcha?
Yes. Muscat is a great product from Brazil. It's fresh, fruity. And what is great on Serra Gaúcha that you can find the well balance in between sugar and acidity. So I think that's why you have love it. You can find this balance and this natural acidity on the sparklings.
Mm-hmm.
And the Brazilians also love the Muscat. So when you go to Brazil, for sure, 90% of the time, the Brazilians are drinking Muscat. So the industry, they have improved a lot in this kind of product.
Okay. Is it grown anywhere else in Brazil?
Yes, so Muscats is one of the types, but also the traditional sparkling made by Chardonnay, Pinot, and Riesling Italic that is produced very well in Brazil is, I think,
Italic Riesling.
It's I can say that the three together, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Riesling Italic, it's made so famous, the Brazilian sparkling wine.
Italic, is that normal Riesling grape, or what is Italic Riesling?
I'm not an enologist, but I can say that there is the Renano that's from Germany, and this one that's from Italy. So it's a type of Riesling. That gives to the sparkling wine the freshness.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll have to look that up and see if it is the German Riesling. Or there's quite a few European wines got the nickname Riesling. So, okay. And there's quite a few other wee wine regions. A lot of them are clustered down towards the south near that Uruguay, Argentinian area. Mm-hmm. What are the other regions down there?
So in the Rio Grande do Sul state, that is the accounts for almost every of the production in Brazil, we have Campanha, that is right on the border with Uruguay and Argentina. And that region is totally different because it's not so high in altitude. It's more flat and it's very warm during the day and cold at night. So this this difference in temperature, you can get better maturations on the grapes. So you can find great tannins, great Cabernet Sauvignon, as the grapes can maturate much better than Serra Gaúcha.
Oh, okay.
So it's totally different style of wine.
Has it got altitude as well?
No. It's about 300 meters. It's more flat. It's the Pampa region. We call it the Pampa region.
Pampa,
yeah.
What does that mean?
Pampa is like on the horse, on the...
Fields and meadows.
Fields, yeah.
Oh, okay. Excellent.
We have a lot of soya beans and this kind of cultivations on that area as well.
Oh, okay. And what other regions have you got down there?
So nearby Campanha, also Serra do Sudeste.
Just before that, the Campia region, hasn't that changed to now being called the Frontera? Is that
When the World Trade Commission recognized some the regions from Brazil, they have recognized it as frontier. But frontier is, you know, Brazil has 8,000 kilometers of frontier. So if you just say that, doesn't say which part of the frontier. And in the last 3 or 4 years, they define it that it's called Campanha, and it's some cities, and that's why we have changed the name.
Did they get upset because of Campania or something like that, one of the European regions?
I don't know exactly, no.
Okay, so what are the wine regions you're saying?
I was saying about Serra do Sudeste, that is nearby Campanha. More or less, it's the same climate conditions. It's basaltic soil as well. It's great for the maturation of the grapes, especially for the reds. Mm-hmm. But also, we are getting great results with Pinot Noir, some whites as Pinot Grigio, Sauvignon Blanc. It will be really great on that area.
Okay. And then moving a bit further north, you've got the...
Moving for the north, and the next state you can find Santa Catarina. It's a wonderful state in Brazil, beautiful landscape and beautiful beaches. But one special region that we call Planalto Catarinense. And on Planalto Catarinense is the highlight. So here is altitude. Yep. It's 1,000 meters altitude. And the Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc also is great. And the Pinot Noir, but the Pinot Noir and Sauvignon Blanc from 1,000 meters altitude is totally different than Serra do Sudeste, that is 200, 300 meters. So
sure.
Brazil is a huge country. And you cannot expect Brazil as a country just one wine.
No, for sure.
It's a country of the diversity, different styles of products. But even you can find different regions in different styles of production, different soils. When you taste a Brazilian wine, I think the best thing you can find that you can feel what's Brazilian wine is the Brazilian wine style is moderate in alcohol. Usually it's in between 12 or 13, 5 degrees. It's not so oaky. It's very well balanced in between sugar and acidity. So this kind of thing makes the Brazilian wine so different from the New World wines that you usually taste.
They're quite close to the equator. They're right, you know, we call our, my company 30-50 because grapes grow between latitudes 30 and 50 degrees latitude, whereas you guys are really clustered right on the extremes of that high temperature boundary, aren't you? But you've got a bit of altitude. It seems like you've got a bit of altitude to help keep the temperature down a wee bit.
So down the south is four seasons, is no irrigated, is natural conditions. So, but if you move to the northeast of Brazil near equator, that is in between 8 and 9, you can find San Francisco Valley.
Yep.
So in that area, yes, is very dry, and we can find two crops per year. And the vineyards, they just can make one production because they have the river called San Francisco, and they control the harvest with the pruning. So yeah, so that's the way they are doing there, and it's amazing because if you look at 1 hectare of land, they divide it in 4 different spots, and they have one that is summer that they are harvesting, and on the side you can see one that is on winter time cycle. So I think this is the amazing thing, you can harvest all year long.
Oh, okay. So if you've got like a grid of 4 and you're just controlling what parts are flowering at a particular time. And how do they do that? Through pruning, you said?
Yes, through pruning and irrigation. So that's the way they are doing. And if you look on the Brazilian map from Petrolina down the from the down, there is 4,000 meters, 4,000 kilometers distance. So if you realize 4,000 kilometers
in
between
distance.
Regions is... If you are based in Europe, it's huge.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And what grapes do they grow up in San Francisco?
Shiraz, Cabernet Sauvignon, and on the white, the Muscats.
Yeah.
It's incredible. They have a great production, some Chenin Blanc and different varieties they are testing there.
What's Shiraz?
Shiraz.
What's Shiraz? Shiraz. Shiraz. Sorry, yeah. Pronunciations. I didn't quite clock that. Okay, all right. So you got quite a range of styles all over Brazil. It's quite a new, in my view of the world, you know, I don't really think of Brazil. I only really noticed Brazil as a wine region a couple of years ago, and that might be a bit of my ignorance. But what's the history of winemaking in Brazil?
So it's quite new because even the Italians went to Brazil in 1875 until the end of 19th. I can say at the beginning of 2000, they was just focused in the domestic market. And more than that, they was preparing the wineries for the market. In the last 10 years, the Brazilian wine industry, they have made a revolution in terms of technology, in vineyards, and everything. And it's Italian families. It's totally family business. So I can say that the new generations, they send the young Italians to study in Mendoza and in France. And when they come back to Brazil, they start looking to the external market to export, to be more on the international market.
Sure. You say it's Italian, but I always think of Brazil as Portuguese. And I did an interview with a lady from Portugal ages ago, and she said, you know, Portuguese sent a lot of wine to Brazil, which surprised me because my ignorant, I always thought South America was Spanish speaking, but she corrected me that Brazil is Portuguese. So why don't you have a closer link to Portugal than maybe Italy? It seems a bit strange. Mm-hmm. And I've tasted some of your wines earlier yesterday at the show, and you did seem to have a fair old amount of Portuguese grapes, mm-hmm. Tarriga Nacional, Tempranillo. So there was quite a bit of there. So what's the Portuguese connection like, and why do you not consider it a key connection?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think this is the interesting thing about Brazil. Brazil is a very open country. So the Portuguese settled, they were colonized by the Portuguese. But the Italians moved to Brazil as they immigrating after the war. And they got the Japanese, they got a lot of countries. We have a lot of immigrations in Brazil. So it was the Italians that came with the vineyards, with the vines. But at the end of, I think it was around the 18, the French paradox, changed a lot of things on the world, and even in Brazil. So if you look at
You mean the French paradox where they live long and drink lots of red wine?
Yes.
Okay, so, and the tannic grape is quite a big one.
Yeah, so what happened in Brazil? Even if you look, it was the Portuguese, then the Italians arrived with the Italian grapes, but with the French, if you look at the grapes we have planted in Brazil, most of them are French.
Yeah.
So it's I think it's term of market as well. So the Brazilians also love Cabernet, as everybody loves. And sometimes the industry is also pushing for the grapes that the market is requesting. I think it's more or less what it happened in Brazil.
Okay. There's a burgeoning, I call it an AOC, indication of origin, mm-hmm. Coming through Brazil. Do you want to just tell us a wee bit about what it is and what sort of controls it has and what regions are sort of bound by it?
Serra Gaúcha, as I was saying at the beginning, is the main wine region. And inside Serra Gaúcha, we have a sub-region called Vale dos Vinhedos. So Vale dos Vinhedos, it was the first geographical indication in Brazil. And it happened in 1996. And what is great at Vale dos Vinhedos? It's a small region, mm-hmm. and they have realized that a part of the sparkling wine, some reds, and some of the wineries, they had a great potential for the grapes, for the wines, and also for the enotourism. So they have prepared themselves for receiving the international visitors. You say that it's a small Napa Valley in Brazil. small if you compare also in terms of visitors. Got about 150,000 visitors per year in that area. So most of the wineries as Miolo, as Casa Valduga, Lidio Carraro, they are based at Vale dos Vinhedos. And it was the first one that it was looking for the quality wines.
Okay. But the other regions, such as the San Francisco Valley, they've applied for it as well, haven't they?
It's quite new, the geographical indications in Brazil. And our worry that it takes time. And also, more than this, you need to discover what it's working better in each region. Campanha, for example, the vineyards, they are 5 years old. So how can I say now which kind of grapes can do well at Campanha? So it takes time, and you have to realize and discover what is the best, and then recognize that the region has that kind of product and working on that.
We mentioned the UK as sort of a market you're trying to break into. How much wine is exported out of Brazil?
To UK, it's not so much. I can say that it's less than 10% of our exports nowadays.
Yep.
The biggest markets for Brazil is US and Germany so far. And
Germany?
Germany.
Do they like the sparkling Moscato?
No, not so much Muscats. They are importing more the traditional sparkling wine.
Okay.
And the reds as well. What I can say that in the last years, you are just doing the homework. You need to find first the importers, build the distribution, and nobody start buying containers. They start buying pallets.
Yeah.
And they need to be established on the market. So if you just look on the numbers, it's not a little bit. It's not too much, sorry. But it's increasing year by year. And more than this, if you look at the same wineries, they are coming for the last 6 years to London International Wine Fair. They really want to make business with this country. So it takes time.
Yeah, for sure. Excellent. All right, Andrew, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers. Hope you enjoyed that interview. Brazil is a bit of a strange one. I've tried some of their wines. They go on about the reds and their normal traditional sparkling wines, but I really like their low alcohol, sweet sparkling wines. I think they're fantastic. Now, Andrea mentioned Riesling Italico, and it's a synonym for Welsh Riesling, which I'm far more familiar with. Not an expert by any stretch, but I know a bit more about that. And according to Oz Clark's book, no, not his Let Me Tell You About Wine book we've just reviewed, but his rather excellent reference book, Grapes and Wine, that we reviewed quite a while ago, it produces a floral, nutty, and crisp wine, and it's grown in the northeast of Italy around Friuli and Veneto. So that probably explains why it's been grown there, because it's an Italian grape variety, or at least grown a lot in Italy. Next week, we're going to be visiting Pegasus Bay Wines in Waipara, New Zealand. That's in North Canterbury. Quite a small region, but the one region in New Zealand which increased its volumes last year. But before we finish up, we're going to be looking at the answer to our mystery producer, and it was Opus 1. Big famous wine there. And finish off with, we have our quote. And this week's quote comes from German priest Martin Luther, who initiated the Protestant Reformation. "He who loves not wine, women, and song remains a fool the whole life long." Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.